situation we have now in Europe, a divided Europe, started already as early as 1863. That was a very important date in the history of Christianity, because in this date, two monks from Constantinople or from Byzance went to, as missionaries, to the slaves, to the Slavian people, the monk Kirill and Theophilos. And that was very important for the whole understanding of the situation in Europe, because already then started the division in Europe between East and West, because these two monks went on from the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And that means the whole East of Europe is influenced by the Orthodox tradition. I have to explain it a bit. The whole Christian idea was very early divided into a Western part and an Eastern part. And the Eastern part is the part of the Constantinople area where the Orthodox Church is located. Orthodoxy means the right doctrine. And it's a bit difficult to explain the whole difference between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic tradition, the Western tradition of the Church. It depends a bit on the understanding of Greek and Latin or Roman thinking. The Greek thinking is more oriented on philosophy, on art, and is more interested on the wholeness of life. The Roman thinking is more politically, is more law-oriented, and is more interested in military. And this was very influential for the whole theology of the Orthodoxy and the Roman Catholic tradition. And some people say that the division of Europe today, the political division in the communist part or an eastern part and the western part, is not as deep as the division between eastern and western thinking. And the whole western world comes from the Roman western thinking. So that was the first very decisive moment in the history of Europe and in the history of the encounter of communism and Christianity, 863, when the two monks went from Constantinople to Bulgaria. And they, by the way, they invented the Cyrillic alphabet to explain the gospel in the native language of the people there. The second important date, I don't want to bother you too much with history, but the second important date for the encounter of communism and Christianity was Martin Luther. And that may surprise many of you, because nobody would connect Martin Luther with communism. But Martin Luther's reformation of theology and of the church had a great impact on the whole development of philosophy in Europe and in the whole world. The main discovery in the Reformation was, in my opinion, that there is a direct link between God and human beings. There is no clergy, no hierarchy, no priest between God and human beings. But there's a direct link, and everybody can use and can have this direct link between God and him or herself. And this idea, this discovery by Martin Luther, was the beginning of the New Age, the beginning of the modern times, because the whole development of religious freedom, the whole development of individualism is depending on this discovery that every individual has a relation to God, not via the church as the body, not via a hierarchy, but direct, God and I. this individualism led in Europe, I have to cover ages here, led in Europe to a kind of secularism and a kind of atheism, and that happened so that, let's see, so Martin Luther said in his explanation to the first commandment that every human being has a relation to a superior. Every human being has a relation to a God. And the question is only if that is a relation to a true, to the true God, or if it is a relation to an idol or to a false God, which can be everything, which can be success, money, relation to the family, whatever. Everything can be a false God. And this explanation of the first commandment inspired a German philosopher named Ludwig Feuerbach to the idea that not the relation between God to the human beings is the origin of religion, but the creativity of human beings. So every human being creates his or her own God. And the whole idea of the existence of God is only the existence of a lack in humanity. And this was a famous critique by Ludwig Feuerbach against every religion, that religion is only an expression of a wish for perfection in human beings. The human beings create their own gods because they long for wholeness and they long for perfection. I cannot explain that too much, but this was very influential for Karl Marx then. And now we are really in the beginning of communism and in the beginning of Marxism. The whole philosophy of Karl Marx is, on the one hand, very economic oriented. On the other hand, it has a strong critique on religion. And this critique is mainly influenced by this Ludwig Feuerbach. Karl Marx said in his famous critique on the law philosophy of Hegel, and that is a famous definition of religion till now in all communist countries, and everybody knows that probably here too, religion is the opium of the people. And I read a bit more from Marx from this work. The basis of irreligious criticism is this: man makes religion. That is Feuerbach. Man or humanity makes religion. Religion does not make man. The struggle against religion is, therefore, indirectly a struggle against that world whose spiritual aroma is religion. Religious suffering is at the same time an expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the sentiment of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of man is a demand for their real happiness. The call to abandon their illusions about their conditions is the call to abandon a condition which requires illusions. So, the main critique Karl Marx had toward religion was that as the opium, as a kind of comfort for the people in their oppression, leads that people don't free themselves from these oppressions in their environment. And Karl Marx demanded that people have to learn to construct a world where they don't need religion, where they don't need comfort, in a world without heart, in a world without comfort. And that is, till now, till today, the basic idea of critique on religion in communist countries. But on the other hand, I don't know if you hear that, it is not a total critique. It is, on the other hand, an awareness that religion has something to do with the need of the people, because people need that comfort. And the idea of Karl Marx was only to construct a world where this comfort wasn't given by a supernatural idea, but by the conditions of society. So the struggle between religion and communism did not really start with Karl Marx, the antagonism between religion and communism. The real struggle started with Lenin. And now we have to remember what I mentioned first. 863, the two monks, Kirill and Theophilus from Byzance, went to to the Slavian people. That brings a total new and different condition of Christianity and of the church than Karl Marx experienced in England and in Germany. Because in Germany, it was a time after the Reformation, and Germany still was influenced by the Western thinking of the Roman world, whereas the East was influenced by the Orthodox thinking and the Greek world. And that had a strong impact on the situation of the church in Russia. Russia was Christianized about 100 years later than these two monks went to Bulgaria. And in Russia, the Christianity and the nationality, the feeling of the Russian people, were one thing, became one thing. And Russian became the holy nation, and the Orthodox Church, after the fall of Byzance, the Russian Orthodox Church was the only remaining Orthodox Church. And therefore there is a strong feeling of keeping this tradition of the Orthodoxy. And at the same time, the church and the Caesar were one thing. The Tsar in Russia was the head of the Orthodox Church. You don't have this struggle between Caesar and the Pope you had in the Western world, in the Roman Empire, and then later in the struggle between the nationalities in Europe, France and Germans, against the Pope. You don't have that in the Orthodox world. In the Orthodox world, there was no conflict between the political power and the church. And therefore, the criticism of Lenin against the church and against Christianity was much more radical, and I have some quotations by Lenin which show that he was not only an atheist or against religion, but he had a strong impact on being anti-religious. Adjectives he combined with religion were filthy, disgusting, notorious, nasty, terrible. And other nouns he combined with religion was infection, darkness, poison, hocus pocus, misbelief, fog, necrophilia, obscurantism, intoxication, self-abasement, and prejudice. That is the context, the words, the linguistic context in which Lenin put religion. And you can see that is quite different from the critique on religion Marx had. Lenin, for the first time in the history, tried to de-Christianize a whole nation. And therefore, the influence of Lenin on atheism and on the struggle between atheism and Christianity was very strong. For the first time after Constantine the Great, a political leader tried to de-Christianize a whole nation. And of course, not by a development as it was predicted by Karl Marx. Karl Marx said, if we construct a just society, there will be no need of religion. Lenin said, we have to kill religion, and we have to fight against religion because religion is the first enemy of our new society. And that struggle inside of the whole Marxist idea between being atheist and being anti-religious is till now very important to understand the situation in the Eastern European countries. And the first thing I have to mention when I speak about the Eastern European countries, they are all very different. Americans tend to put all communist countries in the same direction. They say, well, they are all communist. And they have an idea of Russia and maybe an idea of the serious America, and that's all what they think most Americans about communism. The situation in the different communist countries is very, very different, especially the situation of the relation between Christianity and the ruling Communist Party. And that is dependent on the very different histories you find in the different communist countries. Bulgaria, Russia, and Romania are Orthodox countries. In these countries, the Orthodox Church is very strong and is the biggest church. In Hungary, in Poland, and in Czechoslovakia, the Roman Catholic Church is the largest church. And the relation between state and church is very much influenced by this fact. In East Germany, and that makes East Germany kind of unique in the communist countries, communism met for the first time a Protestant church. There are different Protestant churches in Czechoslovakia too, in Hungary too, but they are minorities. In East Germany, the major church is the Lutheran Church. And that brings a total different situation for the relation between state and church. I want to tell a bit about the understanding of religion today in the communist countries. There is a development in the last 10 years maybe, but there is still an official standpoint toward religion. And I quote as an example from a lexicon of East Germany. The dialectical materialism, that is the official name of the Marxist philosophy, the dialectical materialism founds its fight against religion consequently on a scientific basis. The socialist workers' movement does not only proclaim scientific atheism, but works on the overcoming of religion. Religious faith and scientific thinking are unreconcilable antagonisms. That is still, in all communist countries, the state doctrine, that religious faith and scientific atheism, which is one part of the Marxist ideology are antagonisms. They are not reconcilable. But to understand what materialism in the Soviet Union and in the communist countries means, you have to learn that there are different kinds of atheisms. There is an atheism in the Western world, and there is an atheism in the Eastern world, in the communist world. The atheism in the Western world is not political oriented, but is theory. One famous example for that is Bertrand Russell. He is a philosopher, and because of his philosophical thinking, he came to the conclusion that you have to explain the world without God. That is philosophical atheism. But the atheism in the communist countries is very much political oriented. That means atheism is a form of controlling the mind of the people. Religion always tends to give people room for their own ideas. It's a kind of contradiction because on the one hand, religion means an incorporation in a large community of believers, but on the same time, religion means the individual is important, and religion and the relation between God and the individual makes the individual important. And that is not, that is against the doctrine of the political atheism, which makes the community important but the individual unimportant. The second difference between Western atheism and Eastern atheism is that Western atheism is not anti-religious. That means it has no interest in fighting religion. It maybe thinks that religion is kind of superstition or some people need that or whatever, but it has no interest in fighting religion. The Eastern atheism has a strong interest in fighting and proclaiming atheism as a doctrine against religion. And we will see that especially in the on the situation in the Soviet Union. And the third thing, the Western atheism is not a collective confession. It is a personal, an individual conviction of people, which can be discussed. In the Eastern world, you have to confess your atheism, your atheistic worldview. That is a big difference too. Let's come to the situation of the Soviet Union. You will often hear in official statements by the Soviet Union and by other communist countries that every communist country guarantees religious freedom. And in a way that is right, because all communist countries have in a way in their constitution articles about religious freedom. But in the Soviet Union, this is the weakest article compared with other constitutions of communist countries. Because the Soviet constitution guarantees only limited religious freedom. And on the other hand, it guarantees unlimited atheistic propaganda. In the Soviet Union, you are not allowed to be a Christian without being registered in a church. That means you have to register officially. There's no church allowed to form a congregation. You have to register by the state authorities. The church is not allowed to have property. All church buildings belong to the Soviet state. Not a single church building belongs to the church in the Soviet Union. churches are not allowed near schools, near military camps, near party houses, near union houses, and near kindergartens. The church is not allowed to do any religious education. The church is not allowed to have, for example, children participating actively on the worship service, like ministrants in the Roman Catholic Church. You are only allowed to do that after you are 18 years old. And that is a very big problem, especially for churches in the Soviet Union and in Czechoslovakia, that every religious education is very, very difficult. And if you know how important it is for children to grow up in the religious environment, to develop a kind of religious awareness, or however you call that, it's a very great disadvantage of the Christians in the Soviet Union and in other communist countries, that there is a lot of restrictions in religious education. And what is different from many other communist countries is that in the Soviet Union you have a forced atheistic propaganda. I visited the Soviet Union maybe 10 or 12 times, and you find in almost every bigger town, every bigger city, you find a museum for atheism, mainly in churches, in former churches. And in these museums, they show how backwards-oriented Christians are, how they support the imperialism and the Western world, and how they struggle against the new development of communism, and how unscientifically they are. As a big ending in these museums, after you go, you walk around through the exhibition, there's always a astronaut, the uniform of an astronaut, as a last proof that there is no God, because the astronauts didn't find any God in the space. The decline of the Russian Orthodox Church is enormous. In 1914, there were 54,000 churches in the Soviet Union, which was at this time Russia. In 1938, that means after Stalin's dictatorship, it was a decline to 300 churches, from 54,000 to 300. And then after the Second World War, it went up again, because there was a different politic toward Christianity, and it went up to 22,000 again in 1959. That was Khrushchev era. Until 1970, it went down again to 7,500. So it's now, and now it's estimated around 6,000 churches in the Soviet Union. That means working churches. Priests, from 51,000 in 1914 to under 10,000 in 1938, then up to 34,000 in 1959, and today around 6,000. That means one-tenth of the priests in 1914. And I could give you more figures, but that gives you an idea about the decline of the churches. And the same figures are true for East Germany, Czechoslovakia. I don't know exactly how it is in Hungarian. But in East Germany, for example, the decline of the church is from about more than we lost about more than 60% of the members of the church in 40 years of East German existence. And there is a beginning and a continuous atheistic fight in the press, for example, of the Soviet Union. And what concerns the Soviet leaders more than Christianity is an atheism. And that means that people don't care. They are not interested in atheism, and they are not interested in religion, but they don't care. And that makes Soviet leaders very angry and worried. There was an article in 85 in the Pravda, that means after Gorbachev, which said a considerable part of the population is still religious, and that is a lack, that is depending on the lack of vigilance and the of the people. We have been not severe enough in the fight against religion, and churches still try to grab especially young people. And then there was a special accusation that the West, the Western world, uses religion as a weapon against the communist system. Many people here ask me about the change of policy in the Soviet Union after Gorbachev. I cannot tell much about the political change in the Soviet Union, but one thing is clear: Gorbachev till now made no statement about a new politics towards the churches. So we don't know, but this article in the Pravda of 85 is an indication that there will be no change in the church policy of the Soviet Union. The other two countries which are strongly influenced by Orthodoxy is Romania and Bulgaria. The churches in Romania seem to enjoy a relative prosperity, but that is only as long as they do not venture outside restricted confines designated from them. That means as long as the church keeps in the church buildings and does the liturgy, which is very important for the Orthodox Church, that is the most important thing for the Orthodoxy, the worship, the liturgy. As long as the Orthodox Church in Romania doesn't make any political statements, they seem even to be supported by the state. And that is a typical development in the areas where Orthodoxy belongs, a combination between political power and religion. The same goes for Bulgaria. I have a quotation about Bulgaria, and which shows very clearly how strongly the impact of the communist propaganda and the Orthodox churches in Bulgaria. The Patriarch Kirill of the Bulgarian Orthodox Church speaks about the dialogue between communists and Christians. Our dialogue is carried on every day through work and love of our country. Every day we work together for the good of our country. Too many persons abroad who have asked me, either provocatively or of curiosity, whether there is a sincere closeness and cooperation between believers and non-believers in Bulgaria, I have replied in conformity with the reality. In a family there can be both believing and non-believing members, but they love each other because they are bound together by blood. Our national family is like that. In it there are both non-believers and believers, but all work together for the well-being of our country. This is called creative dialogue, which rather significantly differs from the verbal one. That's a statement of a Bulgarian patriarch, and you could find the same quotations by patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. which is very interesting for the ecumenical dialogue between Orthodox, Protestant, and Roman Catholic churches, and their discussion how far a relation between state and church can go. The Russian Orthodox Church tends to support the political system despite the fact that the ideology or the philosophy of the system is a militant atheistic. That is, I run a bit out of time, that is about the Romania, Bulgaria, and Russia. In Poland, we find a very different situation. And everybody of you knows about the strong influence of the Roman Catholic Church in Poland. And that is, of course, again, part of the history of Poland. Poland was divided several times to Russia and to Germany, and there was times where Poland did not exist. And the only guarantee for the Polish nation was the Roman Catholic Church of Poland. And therefore, you have a strong combination between Christianity and nationality in Poland. And I show you some slides very soon, and you find in every Polish church a Polish flag, of course, which is strange for an East German, which is probably not strange for an American, because you find in almost every church in America an American flag. But probably in West Germany it would be very strange too to have a German flag in the church. And because the Roman Catholic Church is that strong in Poland, you have the unique situation that even party members, and I think that's only the case in Poland, even party members of the Communist Party belong to the church. That is impossible in East Germany, that is impossible in Russia, in Czechoslovakia, probably in Hungary too, I don't know. And of course, that gives the church a great power because it has a real national strength. And when I show you the picture of an inside of a Polish church, you find, of course, till now, the Solidarność signs in Polish churches, because the church supported the movement of the union, the free union Solidarność. In Czechoslovakia, we have, again, a very different situation. And that started, again, long, long time ago in history. Around 100 years before the Reformation in Germany, there started already a Reformation in Czechoslovakia, or in the area which is now Czechoslovakia, by Jan Hus, who was then burned in Konstanz. And therefore, the Protestant churches have a long history in Czechoslovakia, but they are very small and very divided. You have Protestant churches from the Hussite tradition, you have the Brethren's, the Moravian Church, the Lutherans, all kind of evangelical churches. And that means the Protestant churches in Czechoslovakia are very weak because they have no real community among themselves. And the main church in Czechoslovakia is the Roman Catholic Church. But the encounter of communism and the Roman Catholic Church is quite different from the encounter of communism and the Protestant churches, because the Roman Catholic Church is not only hierarchical organized, but has its center in Rome. That means abroad, from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, from Hungary. And that lead, of course, to conflicts between the communist governments and the Roman Catholic Church. That is more the case in Hungary than in Czechoslovakia. But still, there is a very tense relation between the Roman Catholics and the state in Czechoslovakia. I have to be very short about that. I mean, I could I could talk for a long time about that. What is important for Czechoslovakia too is that pastors and the whole theological education is organized by the state, which brings the church in a very difficult situation. A pastor is paid by the state, and a professor of theology is paid by the state. And that brought a lot of difficulties, especially after 68, the invasion of Warsaw Pact troops into Czechoslovakia. Because from then on, a kind of opposition movement developed in Czechoslovakia, not only Christians, but a lot of Christians participated in this movement, and they got conflicts with their church. Because the state has an influence on the church, the state could tell the church, dismiss these pastors. And I have a very close friend who works now as a construction worker in Czechoslovakia. He was a former pastor. He has a PhD in Old Testament, but he cannot work for the church because he is a member of the opposition movement in Prague. That makes the situation quite different from the church, for example, in East Germany. But I come to East Germany later. A few words about Hungary. I'm not, I don't know much about Hungary. But Hungary is mostly Roman Catholic. 70% of the Christians are Roman Catholic, 20% are Reformed, and only 5% are Lutheran in Hungary. And you all know the story about 56, the uprising in Hungary, and the conflict of the church which was involved in this uprising. You know that the cardinal, what was his name?
Vincent.
Yeah, lived in the American embassy for quite a while.
Over 20 years.
Over 20 years, yeah. He died, I think, three or four years ago in Austria.
A bit more.
The Lutheran Church is kind of interesting in Hungary, because there was a conflict in the 50s between the Bishop Lajos Ordas and people in the church who tried to work together with the communist government. Work together is maybe a bit too strong, who tried to find a theology which enabled them to live in a communist country and to accept that as a fact for their theology. And one famous name is the Bishop Zoltán Kaldi, who died a couple of weeks ago in Hungary, and he was the president, the elected president of the Lutheran World Federation after the meeting in Budapest. Kaldi made some statements about the relation between the church and the state and the church in socialism. He said, for example, "Through the grace of God, we are privileged to have experienced the epochal change to socialism. The goals of socialism are equal with the destiny of man wanted by God. Therefore, Christians can accept socialism." And he and other theologians in Hungary developed a special theology they called the theology of diakonia, or the understanding of the church being a servant. And that led these people, these theologians, to a greater acceptance of the political reality in their country, and to find the standpoint of the church and the task of the church in this situation as being a servant for the people. But on the other hand, that led to an apolitical church. The church had no interest in making political statements. And that is almost the same in almost all communist countries, beside Poland and East Germany, that the church does not understand its role in these countries, as a political task. And we discuss that later in the week, if the church has a political task or not. It's almost 4:45. I quickly go through some slides, very, very few slides about, could you switch on the projector? Which gives you some pictures just about churches. It's always easier to remember some stuff if you saw some. It's on the back of the projector.
Back right.
And then we have some time for questions. This is in Kiev, still in the time of Brezhnev. That was the first time I was in the Soviet Union. Must be in 75 or so. And that's very typical for the Soviet Union, at least till the Gorbachev era. These big posters of the political leaders are around everywhere, on every railway station and on every town hall and so on. To understand the situation in the Soviet Union, you have to imagine that in the Soviet Union lived several hundred nations. It's a very, very big country, you know, and all kinds of different religions are there. I mean, there's not only the encounter of Christianity and communism, but the encounter of Islam and communism. This is in Georgia, in Russian Georgia, in Tbilisi, an Orthodox church. On the other hand, on the Baltic, you have the three Baltic republics, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latland, where the Protestant churches are pretty strong, especially the Lutherans. This is a Lutheran cathedral in Tallinn, Estland, Estonia. And these are three Lithuanian boys, my best friends in the Soviet Union. And my whole attitude towards the Soviet Union changed a lot during my traveling there. Because before I traveled in the Soviet Union, I had only political ideas about the Soviet Union. But now I have personal contacts to people there, and that changes a lot in the attitude toward a country. This is Bulgaria, a southern country, southern Europe, much influenced by the Greek culture, and of course by the Orthodox Church. This is the main cathedral of the Orthodox Church in Sofia, Bulgaria. And this is another Orthodox church in Sofia. Romania, where I experienced the celebration of the Ascension of St. Mary in August, I think on 10th of August, I don't remember quite. 15th of August, okay. Which was a very big celebration, and all the people from all the villages came around to the monastery and stayed the whole day together in worship. There was only worship, no program or something like that, but worship the whole day, from the very morning till the night. But in Romania still exists a minority of Germans who are Lutheran, and they face a lot of problems in Romania. This is a Lutheran church in Transylvania. That is a marketplace in Warsaw, Poland. And here you see it's a bit too dark, this picture, but the, of course, the cross, the Polish flag, forms the victory sign and Solidarność. That was after the martial law in Poland. Could never happen on the street, but in the church it happened. And the last picture is Czechoslovakia. This is Prague. And Prague is a town full of churches. That were all my slides about the communist countries. And we have still some time, not much time. I promise the next time I keep myself short and we can discuss more. And I know there are many questions about my own situation and how I came here and all this stuff. There is opportunity to ask that when I speak about East Germany. And so I open it up the last 10 minutes for if there are any questions, interest, comments.
Well, do you want to start out by telling us how you do happen to be here in Holden?
Okay, I can tell that shortly. It is kind of unique that I'm here, because it's not very often that East German, especially in my age, are allowed to travel. And I am the first theologian of East Germany who was allowed to leave the country for a year to teach in the United States. And I taught at two Lutheran seminaries in Columbus, Ohio, and in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And it was only possible by the help of the Lutheran World Federation, which applied for an exchange program. And it was very difficult, and I waited for over 3 years to get the visa, and I got my passport the day before I left. And I never believed it, that it would happen, but it happened, and so I'm here. And hopefully it is not only a unique situation, but there will be a follow-up and other people will be allowed to come here too, because I had a very wonderful experience here. And this is my ending of the program, a month of Holden, and I think it's a very nice ending, a happy ending.
You said that they confess their atheist view. To whom? To whom do they confess this?
To the party.
Party.
You have to confess atheism if you want to be an accepted member of the party or an accepted member of society. And that is one struggle of the East German church, because in the 50s they introduced a kind of atheistic confirmation for kids. And the church had to struggle with that. Could they allow their children to take part in this, with the knowledge that the kids would have a lot of difficulties if they wouldn't participate? If you want to be a member of the Communist Party in East Germany, you have to sign that you're not a member of the church. So it is a kind of proclamation towards the party and an acceptance of the atheistic, materialistic philosophy. A very small percentage, yeah. Not more than, I guess, 10%.
And only the Socialist Unity Party, or as a member of the East CDU, maybe the Christians or of the Liberal Party?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is, again, something special for East Germany, and we come to this later. We have the unique situation in East Germany that there is no one-party system. And that is only the case in East Germany as the only communist country. In all other communist countries, there is only a one-party system, the Communist Party. In East Germany, there are other parties, and members of the other parties are allowed to be Christians. And there is especially a party for Christians, which is a Christian Democratic Union. But what that all means, I cannot explain in 5 minutes. We have to talk about that. That's a very sensitive and interesting problem. Well, if you decide to form a congregation and not register, you do it against the law, and these people have to face prison. And there are many cases of Christians who are in prison in the Soviet Union, especially Baptist Christians. I don't have the exact figures.
Why did they choose to go that way instead of registering? I mean, obviously for more freedom, I would think.
Yeah, because they do not accept this law. Oh, you cannot do a home Bible study. That's almost impossible. Because that is a group formation, which is the most dangerous thing to do in communist countries. Which is quite different in East Germany. But the laws are existing in East Germany too, but the state does not interfere in meetings of Christians in private apartments. But in the Soviet Union you cannot do that. You can only gather in churches.
It's even forbidden to say prayers in your own home when you have guests.
Yeah.
You maybe don't know or who are ethnic.
Yeah, because that would be religious propaganda, and religious propaganda is forbidden by the law.
But you would also be unable to hold any Bible study at home because the flats are so small.
Yeah, that's...
People are living on 5 square meters.
Yeah, so...
5 square meters for 10 people?
The home.
The home is
hard. Yeah.
There's no way.
I mean, you really cannot compare... the situation here and then put a communist government and expect that as the Soviet Union. But the whole culture, the whole life of people are different. And I will speak a bit about that tomorrow, about the life of the people in East Germany, which is quite different from the life of people. No, I wouldn't say that. But the church is a national identification institution, so that even people from Solidarność can identify with the church and people from the party. And that is very unique if you compare that with the situation of churches in other communist countries, because the first thing you have to consider if you are a Christian is a commitment toward Christianity and towards a religious faith. In Poland it is a bit different. There's not only religion but nationality. And because the church is that big national institution, people can identify with the church despite their diversity and their personal beliefs and personal longings.
And you must know that in Poland a very big number of party members were sympathizers or even members of the Solidarność movement. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
I think maybe a third of the party members were new to the Solidarność movement.
Otherwise, Solidarność wouldn't have any chance if there wouldn't be a power inside the power system which supported Solidarność.
How close were they to a revolution from Russia at that point, with that many political members?
Well, that's always the question, what could have happened, which is very difficult to answer. I don't think that that Poland had any chance to go off the Warsaw Pact. So the question was only whereas the Russians would invade or the Polish people do it by themselves. And it was the first, it was the second option which happened, that Jaruzelski stopped the movement. But I don't think that if there would have been any political overtaking by Solidarność that the Russian would have accepted, especially because Poland is in the middle of the Warsaw Pact. I mean, Poland is the only country, is that the only, no, Romania too, which has no border to the west.